Hello and welcome back to Energy Transition Today. I'm Oliver.
I'm Dila.
I'm Maya.
And we're here to bring you the latest news and analysis from the energy transition. Plenty to go through today. We'll be going over quite a lot of tender and auction stories from the news this week. Maya will be bringing us the latest on AR6, AHR2 and NY5. All those acronyms and more to come a bit later. We'll also be going through some of the pros and cons of the Development Consent Order system and Nationally Significant Infrastructure Projects, the NSIP. We'll be picking apart that system. Dila will also be taking us through some of the latest developments from the European Union when it comes to supporting the hydrogen industry. We'll be discussing various things, including the Hydrogen Bank's auction as a service model. But before we get into anything else, I'm just going to mention that Inspiratia has this week released our latest league tables. The Q1 European Energy Transition League tables are out now. They were released yesterday as you're listening to this. In the report, we break down the top lenders and top advisors in the energy transition. If you want some full details on that, that's all available now on the website. But for now, I'm going to hand over to Maya with the news.
So starting off with the hydrogen subsidy scheme in the UK, the application deadline for the second round of hydrogen grants, HAR2 if you will, closed last week, and the market as a whole appears a bit more optimistic about this one compared to its predecessor, which failed to meet its procurement target. So this grant is disbursed by DESNZ, which had a target to procure about 250 megawatts of electrolyzer capacity in round one, but ended up awarding grants to just about 125 megawatts. They went a lot more ambitious with this round, starting off with 750 megawatts during the market sounding phase last year, and upped the capacity to 875 megawatts when the grant opened for submissions a couple of months ago in February. DESNZ clearly feels the market is behind this round, and the sentiment is largely replicated by the project proponents. For one, average project size is expected to be larger under this round, but it's not all rosy. Some developers fear delay to grant award. Unfortunately, the award date coincides with the UK general election in H2 this year, which could mean that initiatives like this might be put on the back burner until the fight for number 10 is well and truly settled. And some market participants also feel that the project side could potentially be a hindrance when it comes to financing. Essentially, projects allocated under round one were small enough that all but one were able to be financed using equity from the developer and grant funding from DESNZ. Under this round, bigger projects means higher capital costs and the need for external financing. The market as a whole wants to back hydrogen, as we all know, but common sentiment still seems to be that the technology is not sufficiently proven to make commercial lenders comfortable with the risk profile. The only large-scale debt financing in this sector to date seems to be the H2 Green Steel deal in Sweden, but then again, it's hydrogen adjacent. I'm not sure the appetite is quite there for pure-play hydrogen, especially when the market is still in the process of establishing a blueprint for transport and storage.
I think it's a really good point to bring up H2 Green Steel because, as you mentioned, it is a green hydrogen project, but its primary focus is on making steel, and it has built into it that offtake. The pure play hydrogen obviously needs to find the offtaker, and that's been one of the biggest drawbacks to hydrogen projects so far. But yeah, it's interesting to see that that's the UK seems to be betting on debt for the second round.
Well, as we do with most renewables projects, they're hoping that this will go the way of offshore wind some 10 years ago. But I think the uncertainty around transport and what blend and who's actually the end user for this project, it's still very unclear. So I suppose we just have to wait and see.
Following on from that discussion on hydrogen in the UK, I actually want to bring Dila in at this point. This week, you've been writing about hydrogen in the EU.
Yes, that's right.
So what's been going on?
Yeah, a lot has been going on, actually. So even just when you look at some developments that have been going on over the last few days, in April of this year, the first steps have been taken towards establishing an independent hydrogen grid development body. Basically, it's a sort of new regulation that's aiming to provide an improved coordination for future network planning, as well as give more legal certainty to future hydrogen grid investors, while also overseeing the phasing out of natural gas. At the same time, Germany made news with a few hydrogen stories. Actually, it became the first European member state to participate in the European Hydrogen Bank's new mechanism, which is called Auction as a Service, where the federal government has committed another 350 million euros for electrolyzer projects on top of the existing 800 million that was provided by the European Union Innovation Fund. So this pilot auction is basically aiming to incentivize some of the necessary final investment decisions to support the development of some of these projects and support the market to grow.
How does it differ from a regular auction? Why do we need another auction service, so to speak?
Well, the reason they introduced this was actually because it was aiming to help some of the member states that had not been selected for the Innovation Fund support because of budget constraints that existed. So basically with this auction, they tried to eliminate some of the administrative burdens around that.
So my understanding of this is that the auction as a service is being set up by the European Hydrogen Bank, allowing member states to participate in a hydrogen auction scheme without needing to set up their own national system. Like, for example, the hydrogen business model in the UK equivalent in every European country. The EU is taking some share of that responsibility, and member states can pay into the system, as Germany has done in this case, to have auctions held at the European level within their own country. So the German government doesn't need to go through the administrative hassle of actually dealing with these auctions.
It's somewhat similar to what the likes of EIB and EBRD do with, I suppose, infrastructure auctions.
At the very least, sort of what it's trying to do, it's expected to see the deployment of up to 90 megawatts of electrolyzers, and also for the production of another 75,000 tons of renewable hydrogen. So basically, it will work by providing a route for subsidizing hydrogen producers with direct grants per kilogram of renewable hydrogen produced. And they will be making this support available for up to 10 years, they said. Well, in other news, 24 German projects had also been approved by the European Commission as part of its important project of common European interest, the IPCEI hydrogen program. So that sort of has further strengthened Germany's role within the European hydrogen industry.
How does this scheme within Germany compare to other efforts in Europe?
Yeah, so there was one other one that was quite sort of notable in terms of the investment it's been receiving, which was France in March that received the green light for 900 million euros for this French scheme. And here France is looking to support the production of energy from biomass as well as renewable hydrogen. And that's basically entirely focused on the application in industrial processes and transport. Here the aid will be provided in the form of direct grants and also expected to be operational within 36 months from the date of granting of the aid.
So this is all very promising from the point of view of a hydrogen project developer. It seems like there's lots of opportunities out there for funding. But what kind of challenges have we been seeing in the hydrogen market recently?
Yeah, well, some of the challenges that have been plaguing the hydrogen industry, they still seem to be remaining, really. So one of the most important ones is this sort of mismatch and imbalance between how much these projects cost and how much off-takers are actually willing to pay for them. Sort of the market conditions for renewable hydrogen are just not profitable at the moment. And obviously, these issues are not necessarily expected to be resolved anytime soon, particularly with higher interest rates and inflation as well. So all of these are expected to actually further exacerbate some of the imbalances that exists between construction prices and, again, what off-takers are willing to pay. Even government support, as we've sort of discussed just a moment ago, don't seem to be enough, really. They're not sufficient, particularly because there have been delays that have affected the success of some of these important subsidies, including the one of the IPCEI scheme.
There's also, of course, a mismatch, not just between the price of hydrogen, but also the infrastructure, which, you know, there are more and more steps being taken to sort of build out the infrastructure, the connective tissue of a hydrogen market. But just linking together potential producers and off-takers is a huge problem. We mentioned that under the auction as a service, they'll be providing a subsidy, of course, determined by a bidding process for a price per kilogram of renewable hydrogen produced. That's going to be a really key point in bridging the price difference. We've reported before about the US Inflation Reduction Act. So the way the US system works is that if you fulfill all the criteria that is set out in the Inflation Reduction Act, for example, using sustainable electricity, buying American, which is a big part of that act, you can get up to $3 per kilogram produced flat in tax credits. So you can write that off against any expenses of the project. And that will allow American producers to be cost competitive. I think depending on exactly how generous these auctions are, they'll be able to bring down that price, but they probably still won't be able to compete with places like Australia.
Well, that's again a fever dream. That's their target. The Australian government, the federal government's target is $2 per kilogram, but that is to make that hydrogen as a fuel competitive with its fossil fuel alternatives. So that price is when hydrogen starts to become profitable. But I think we're a long way from that.
And there needs to be a price differential, I suppose, in these two different markets. If these dreams about Australia becoming an exporter of hydrogen, an exporter of energy in the form of hydrogen, there needs to be a price difference between the Australian market and the rest of the world if that is to happen. So I can see why that target's in place, but we'll see if they can get there.
Yeah, so basically market conditions and delayed subsidies are making the build-out, the effective build-out of the hydrogen infrastructure extremely difficult. At this moment in time.
And we have some data on this that's included in the article. So project activity on hydrogen deals has been ticking up quite substantially in the last quarter. We saw an initial spike of interest in hydrogen around about Q2 2021. That kind of level of project activity is now back off the back of things like the UK hydrogen business model, the European Hydrogen Bank. We're really starting to see a lot of projects moving through development. Still very few final investment decisions being made, but projects are progressing. Thank you very much for that, Dila. We're going to now throw back to the news because we've had a lot of updates on offshore tender fronts.
Yeah, offshore is back in the spotlight, so to speak. The AR6, that is the tariff scheme for renewable energy generation in the UK. The application deadline for the sixth round closed last week. Last week has been busy for a lot of auctions. The government is doing its best to incentivize offshore developers, but it's still unclear if raising the CFD strike is enough to attract interest from offshore developers. Again, it's important to keep in mind that up to 1.4 gigawatt of offshore generation vying for a tariff under AR6 is actually capacity that was pulled from AR4, that is the fourth round auction. And AFI, as we all know, did not attract any bids for offshore wind due to the strike price not being high enough. We will have to wait and see if the 73 sterling for megawatt hour offered under AR6 is enough to make up for the rising capex cost and market uncertainty.
So even if the targets are met on AR6, we'll still kind of be behind due to the delays of last year. It's also interesting now that these are every year. They perhaps haven't had all the time to make the adjustments they want to do to the CFD auction system.
I hope we don't see projects rebidding for tariffs, hoping for a higher strike like what we see in the other side of the pond now in the US.
Speaking of the US, I think we've had some New York updates.
Well, yeah, offshore wind again. The New York State Energy Research and Development Authority, NYSERDA, announced plans for its fifth offshore wind solicitation round. It's their version of the CFD allocation round in the UK. They wrapped up the fourth round recently, awarding capacity to three offshore projects. What's notable with the US market is that they can't seem to shake the curse of rebidding. Most of the projects successful in round three were initially awarded contracts in round one. They ended up cancelling their contracts with the state to reapply for a higher tariff under the fourth round. This might be the case again with the fifth round, unfortunately. Last week, NYSERDA cancelled contracts awarded under round three. So around 4 gigawatt capacity proposed by three wind farms may be looking for a contract under the fifth round. This in addition to a couple of projects that were unsuccessful in the fourth round. So yeah, essentially, there is a steady pipeline of new projects being proposed, but the market there is taking its own time resolving the pipeline projects that have been pottering about for a while. And the market conditions are certainly not ideal, and regulations such as the Jones Act put a further strain on delivery timelines. The will is certainly there, but the execution may need a bit of work. They're yet to set a specific date for the launch of NY5, but they're aiming to open the tender sometime this summer.
That problem of rebidding is, again, something we could talk about with AR6, because it's starting to appear in the UK system with examples like Hornsea 3 being broken off from the earlier AR4 and a portion of that now going into AR6.
In AR4, every offshore wind farm that was awarded a contract pulled the maximum capacity allowed under the contract without incurring a fine. So they would have pulled more if they could.
The rebidding curse, I guess, if you're going to keep putting the prices up and allowing rebidding under the same terms, then people are going to keep doing it.
I wonder, we started to become comfortable with offshore being an established technology where the governments can be sort of hands off and let the market sort itself out, and where and the governments can instead focus on the newer technologies like floating offshore and hydrogen. But we seem to be taking a couple of steps backwards.
Yeah, I think that that's very fair. Some of the delays, some of the drawbacks, the limitations in building out offshore capacity in Europe in general. Projects are seeing so many problems if they don't have government backing.
It's a strange one because you see the same developers, let's take Ørsted as an example, they have projects in Sweden, and Sweden is very staunchly not against, but they don't have a CFD tariff scheme, and they have no plans to implement a CFD tariff scheme. But they seem to be getting on with the job there. But when it comes to the UK and the US, they are very adamant that government support is needed, is essential to see these projects through. So it's, it's a bit of a strange one.
Different markets with different needs. Speaking of offshore developers, we've got a DCO from Equinor.
Well, yes. So Equinor-led joint venture secured a DCO for its proposed extension of two offshore wind farms in UK waters. This joint venture, which includes Equinor, Masdar and China Resources, was seeking permits for the extension for a few years now, but the process was delayed as a result of various political wranglings. Now the JV is able to start the process of adding an additional 719 megawatt capacity to Sheringham Shoal and Dudgeon offshore wind farms, both off the coast of Norfolk. They've been operational for a few years now, and the additions, although are two separate projects, will be delivered together as one entity, so to speak. The developers plan to use shared infrastructure, seemingly to cut back on delivery costs. Equinor is being coy about potential offtake agreements, but there is a very good chance that the company applied for a CFD under AR6. So the new capacity, the combined capacity, which is 719 megawatts, is expected to cost around 2 billion sterling to deliver. But again, with things like these, the cost may be adjusted upwards, closer to FID.
Thank you very much, Maya, for the news roundup. Speaking of DCOs, the development consent order, this week I've done a bit of a deep dive into the NSIP, Nationally Significant Infrastructure Project system in the UK. The system has come under quite a lot of criticism recently from various renewable developers. Solar in particular seems to have continued issues with this system. Many projects would rather not have this sort of special form of government support and would rather be classified as just normal projects.
So what are they then exactly?
So nationally significant infrastructure projects, this designation kind of exists for the UK government to help along certain big significant infrastructure projects if they're seen to be important for the country as a whole. So this kind of takes them out of some of the sort of local wranglings where in many places a single, let's say, onshore wind development could be stopped by some local planning level issues. If a project is marked as being nationally significant, then it kind of is taken out of the hands of local officials and the main government in Westminster can make decisions on its progression.
And how is that determined? Is that sort of by generation capacity or?
Yeah, so there's a few different criteria. Generation capacity is actually a really interesting one. So if there is a solar development in the UK, which is 50 megawatts or greater, it is automatically designated as nationally significant. However, one of the interesting things that we've seen in sort of response to this system are strategic project sizings. So there are about 10 really huge, significant solar power farms in the UK, which are currently either in planning or constructed at just underneath the 50 megawatt capacity. There are a significant number of 49.9 megawatt solar farms in the UK.
But that's always been the trend, at least from the news side. We've seen developers favouring that 49.9 megawatt sweet spot because the consensus seems to be that the planning process for that is much quicker and much more streamlined.
Precisely. And that's sort of the paradox of this thing. You have this special system that's meant to speed up projects, which ends up actually slowing it down, where so many of these sites could actually deliver much more power, could deliver more energy for the green transition. But because of this weird quirk of the planning system, developers are deliberately keeping their projects to a lower scale in the UK.
So what are some of these reforms you've mentioned then they're looking to introduce?
So obviously it's not ideal that you have this really sort of strange quirk of the planning system. There have been a few different attempts to address it over the last couple of years. For example, the Nationally Significant Infrastructure Action Plan was published by the Department of Levelling Up, Housing and Communities in 2023 with the attempt to design a fast-track system for speeding up the consenting time of particular projects. However, there have been a few drawbacks that have come out from this as well.
So what are some of the changes they're looking to introduce?
So one of the key things is that they want to move away from environmental impact assessments, which are the normal procedure, to environmental outcome reports. So a subtle change in the
that's
way...
The semantics?
It sounds like an insignificant change. But what that's basically moving away from is moving away from having particular checkboxes where every project has to fill in all these particular requirements and moving to a position where there is an assessment done on the overall impact of a project rather than needing to conform with lots of different steps. This has been a drawback of itself, though, in the view of many. For example, one of the new policies which have been introduced in this change is, for example, a requirement for biodiversity. So now every project has to not only go through all this process that's existing, but also needs to show that after so many years, biodiversity around their project will increase by 10%. And just there are many examples of like this of where actually by taking this out of the local planning system and giving it to national government, it's just slowing things down more and more. And another way that this has tried to be addressed by the government is using these national policy statements. So this is kind of a regular built into the system update where the government can sort of give a steer to what the requirements of these outcome assessments is. But so far, those have not been seen to have a significant impact. In fact, it was just last week where the DLUHC issued their latest guidance aimed at improving the efficiency of the NSIP program. However, their reforms have not been seen to be particularly impactful yet. On the bright side, we have started to see a return to more projects going through the system. Obviously, large projects can't get around it, and the economics of scaling up mean that some projects are going through the system anyway. For example, since the beginning of 2024, we've seen 6 new projects applying through the NSIP system, 4 of those being solar projects. So we are still seeing a scaling up in solar projects, even if they have to go through this process.
But I wonder if it's true reflection of a scale-up with solar PV, because in England especially, there's a moratorium of sorts on onshore wind. So are there, I suppose, feasible renewables generation asset would be a solar project. So I don't know if that essentially means solar projects are somehow on the uptake. It's just that we don't allow onshore wind projects.
I think there's an element of both things going on there. Yes, there are. There's the need to develop renewables and onshore wind has been blocked. In fact, one of the reasons why the system continues to sort of favour delay rather than progress is there is an element of that kind of NIMBYism, the same thing that onshore wind farms are going up against, the same thing that the national government is concerned about. So it's a system which is still obviously undergoing many reforms, but I think that this latest round is probably not going to move the dial particularly.
So plenty of room for improvement.
I just want to mention one other thing. So this isn't like it's just a larger policy area which is just happens to affect the renewable sector. More than half of all the projects submitted under the NSIP, which includes, you know, transport and water and all the rest of it, more than half of the projects that go through this process are energy infrastructure, with the vast majority of those being energy generation. So this is a real problem for energy infrastructure in general, but also kind of goes wider than that into transport. And we talked a lot about EV charging infrastructure. All these projects that go over a certain size need to go through this process.
England might be averse to onshore wind, but we're seeing a slow uptick in these projects on mainland Europe, actually. A lot of new entrants into the sector. Recently, we've published a case study on a pulp manufacturer, paper manufacturer in Sweden, and a forestry manager venturing into this technology and coming in on both ends.
That's right, both producing and using energy. So this was the SCA deal analysis, which readers of Inspiratia will have been able to read earlier this week. Interesting how a lot of companies outside of the energy sector are trying to mitigate the risks of energy use, which the energy markets have, you know, in general been very volatile over the last couple of years, insulate themselves against those risks a bit by using energy generation.
I think this comes back to the problem of firming. So unlike fossil fuels, these end users cannot be sure about the generation of renewable technologies, especially given the fluctuations in the past couple of years. So those who are able to are also venturing into generation, so they have some degree of control over the process of generation and use.
But of course, that breaks down a bit if you have, say, a day of unusually high energy use on a day that happens to be very low in terms of solar and wind generation. The risk still obviously exists.
The risk obviously exists. And even in this case, SEA, they are still, their usage of energy is still from the grid, but they will also be supplying to the grid. So the asset, like what we see in Australia, generation assets are not linked to the end user. The user is drawing from the grid and transmitting to the grid.
Yes, so if you want to read more about the acquisition of Fasikan Wind Farm by SCA, you can read more about that on the Inspiratia website. That is the end for another week. Thank you very much for listening. As I mentioned, we've had our league tables out this week. Please go away and have a look at those. We'll be discussing those more in detail next week. And also, keep your eyes on your Inspiratia inbox. We'll also be releasing another report next week, our quarterly PPA update. We'll be taking a look at the PPA market across Europe. So plenty of interesting updates to follow there. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next week with more news and analysis. But until then, goodbye.
Bye.